Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Chatter Matters podcast. My name is Amog, and I'm the host of this podcast. And I'm really excited today to welcome James Tapachi, who many of you may already have heard of. He actually wears many hats. He's an experienced litigator, lawyer, content creator, podcast host, and also a coffee connoisseur, I'm told. So welcome to the podcast, James, and great to have you. And would you like to introduce yourself to our guests?
I like to think of myself as a coffee enthusiast rather than connoisseur. I've got a terrible palate, but I do enjoy drinking this stuff. No, Amog, I'm delighted to be here. And thanks for the kind intro. I'm a lawyer. I do commercial litigation work in the corporate space. And I've got a couple of other things buzzing along on the sideline as well that we may end up getting to. But sort of apart from my family commitments, my number one role in life, also my number two role, is the practice of law here in the jurisdiction of New South Wales.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And yeah, I think I'm also probably a coffee enthusiast more than a connoisseur, although I do, I have become more judgy as I've progressively tried more coffees, but I do have a
It's a journey we're all on.
Exactly, right? Look, as long as we both like coffee, and I think Melbourne and Australia generally has such a huge coffee culture, which
absolutely.
Is absolutely perfect. So first question of this podcast always is around why the laws. Could you tell the listeners a bit about your journey to the law, why you chose to pursue it, and what sort of factors influenced your decision?
Yes, my dad was a lawyer. His dad was a lawyer. His dad was a lawyer. So all I knew growing up was I never want to do that, man. I'm too cool and too edgy to ever do what my dad did, man. And so my initial pursuit sort of at university was arts and an economics degree. And I ended up focusing on sort of history there, and I didn't pursue the economics as deeply as plan A would have. And then having got okay marks in that arts degree, it was a sort of history bent, I ended up doing what was then called graduate law or a Juris Doctor. But even then, doing graduate law, I wasn't like, yes, you know, this is exactly what I want to do. I still had dreams of being, you know, a pop music journalist, or I had dreams of making rap music, or, you know, writing columns for people, or potentially even lecturing at a university or something like that. I, even into sort of the final class, the final lecture we had of our advanced corporate law class, I was still very much like, no way, man, I'm going to keep this music review stuff going, and that's going to be a big part of what I do. I'm going to be on radio. I'm going to do all this stuff. But as time passed, you know, I completed the degree, and I thought, oh, well, having completed the degree, let's do the professional legal training component. And then having completed the professional legal training component, I thought, oh, well, let's at least get a year or two under my belt. And as time passed, I came to have some basic competence in some areas, and it's nice to feel competent at things some people find difficult. And then as more time passed, look, there are things like lifestyle creep and that kind of thing, but also I came to understand the profession increasingly well, and I came to understand its role in my life and my family's life increasingly well. And so sort of drip over time, the law sort of came and found me, is how it felt. I think, though, in telling that story, there's a very important thing I need to acknowledge, which is the massive privilege of coming from a family where you've seen people go to uni, where you've been given the space to study and to embrace university study yourself, and where you've seen people do the same job over generations. And I think I used to tell that story and say, well, what a crazy coincidence that I just turned out to be a lawyer. It just came and found me. And as time has passed and I've come to understand, you know, the intersectionality of power relationships in everything we see around us, and I've come to understand the huge benefits some people take from their backgrounds, and I certainly put me very much among the very privileged people who got to you know see their parents do a job that I ended up going on to do. So that is the story. The law came and found me, but with the great big footnote underneath that says, oh yeah, by the way, the law also came and found my dad and his dad and his dad as well. So that shouldn't go unmentioned, I don't think.
No, that's perfect. Thank you for saying that. And I think one of the questions I had when you said that was like, did you ever feel the pressure of having to do law just because your dad and your sort of granddad had done law? Like, was there ever that underlying assumption that you will probably end up in the law, given that we've kind of got this in the family now, effectively. So, did you ever feel that kind of while you were at uni or while you were kind of pursuing your interests?
No, I was so lucky. And perhaps this is because they might have had the experience of it themselves from their own parents. I got a very supportive, hands-off approach from my dad to take that example. His view was, look, I'll support whatever you're up to, including this sort of crazy rap career type stuff you're flirting with. That was very unsuccessful. And his role, even as I went into practice at, you know, firms other than the firm he was the chairman of at the time, and you know, that's that sort of thing was, look, there's nothing you need to sort of prove to me. You've got to go on your own professional journey. To the extent I felt pressure, I think, no, I didn't feel any pressure coming from my family at all. To the extent I felt pressure, it was sort of, there's of course a degree where you're excited for yourself, where you have an ambition to say, hey, like the thing that you're doing, I'm doing it too. And that's more an excitement, I suppose, than a pressure. And so I guess the real answer is no, but I feel it worth acknowledging. You know, I love my dad as many people love their dads. And so, you know, I think it would be slightly artificial to say there was zero influence, but even discussing it here with you, it's difficult to pick apart precisely what that really was.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. And I think there's a certain it's a certain thrill in kind of being part of a family who's been lawyers, but equally, like in my case, I know no one in my family is a lawyer. So when I became a lawyer, it was like the first lawyer in the family, super cool. But it's a bit of a double-edged sword, I think, in both cases, right? Like if you've got a family full of lawyers, yes, there may not be pressures as you pointed out, but you've still got that, you know, you got to build up a good reputation. Your families have all been lawyers. Like, you know, make sure that you don't do anything, you know, that sort of, which, you know, is quite nice. But equally, when you're a pioneer within the profession, like, or if you're the first lawyer in your family, that also is quite, brings with it some challenges. Like, you're like, okay, I have no idea who to kind of look up to because I've had no one in my family who's been a lawyer, or I don't know what pathway I'm going to choose for myself, given that, you know, you don't have those role models necessarily, at least in your immediate family. So
I've never had that experience myself. Oh my God. Mm. Obviously it's part of the privilege.
Mm.
And I suspect the way that you just referred to is more difficult, and not to sort of throw you under the bus or spin the camera around to you. I think it is harder when you haven't seen someone right up close make a success of the profession. I think it's harder to do it yourself if you haven't seen that. And so while I don't want to sit around you know, beating myself up for bringing some privileges to a position, or in the alternative, patronizing any member of the profession who might have come from a different background, I think it's only right to say that it is an advantage to see people right up close succeed in the profession, because it's a profession you can't succeed in alone, is really my view. And so you need your mentors and supporters around the place. And I think it's a huge advantage if one of those mentors and supporters has a number of the chromosomes that you're carrying around yourself, and you know, helped change your nappy a few decades ago and that sort of thing.
100%. And I think it's a great segue, because I know you mentioned mentors and kind of the support system. So could you reflect back to your own law school experience and sort of share a bit about, you know, what did you like about it? Because obviously law school experience as a whole has kind of changed quite a bit over the last, you know, 10, 20, even 30 years. The way law was taught back in the 80s or 90s or early 2000s even is not necessarily the way it's taught today. And so there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, lawyers back in the day, at least those I've spoken to, are always like, yeah, we learned the theory. We had to regurgitate a bunch of cases or a bunch of laws. And that used to be the way assessments worked. But obviously, that's no longer the case. And so passing your mind back to your own kind of law school journey, how did you find that whole experience coming from a sort of non-law background, but also, you know, what challenges did you find as you went through it?
I'm very much in the old style, you know, physical lectures. I remember with some pride that I was the first person to bring a laptop to the first lectures in the first year of the 3-year sort of graduate law degree. But then by the end of the 3 years, look, I'll just make up the proportion of 2/3, but a genuine majority. And perhaps absolutely everyone, but I might be wrong, I might be misremembering that slightly, but sort of the laptop had kind of come in. So you're speaking with a dinosaur for whom computers, these crazy things, were a great big sort of revolution in our studies. The challenge for me in part was that I had my attention dragged in a number of different areas. So at the time I was making music, the time I was hosting radio, the time I was working in a pub and hosting trivia nights. At the time I was sort of doing a number of different things while studying law full time. And when I say studying law full time, that is, or it feels like, for reasons I can't really understand, like a full-time legal studies career demanded less time then than it does now. And perhaps that's that bleed of doing remote study, which is must be so difficult to escape for anyone studying now, that the place where you relax and chill out is also the place where a lecturer delivers a lecture. It's also the same place where you're doing your research. It's also the same place where you're drafting your research papers and that sort of thing. So my experience was one where it was very easy to keep the boundaries up and to draw bright lines between when you are doing hard work, law study, when you are doing voluntary work for the community, when you are doing paid work for, you know, some pub you work in. Yeah. And so I had the massive benefit, as did others of my generation, of being able to draw really bright lines between when it was study time and when it was not. And so I reflect back on uni as having like occasional peaks of stress. You're kind of 2-3 weeks around exams. It was reasonably stressful. But it was a uni experience that I was also able to, noting all those privileges I mentioned before, bearing all those privileges in mind, I was able to do a number of other things during uni as well. So I look back on uni with some fondness, and that's in part because of the activities outside of uni. And that's in part because the experience I had was, I think, probably less, at least less intellectually and emotionally demanding than the process demands of students these days.
Definitely. And did you, so two sort of follow-up questions. Did you guys have the Socratic method when you were taught law, or you were just kind of called on for like in a classroom where a lecturer just basically picked on students? Because that used to be the, you know, traditional mindset that most people had based on movies and based on stuff they read about the law.
Yeah, the Legally Blonde method.
Yeah, literally. It's like, you know, if you don't go to class prepared, you're going to be in trouble. So, yeah, was that the sort of approach that was used back in the day, or was it?
No, the approach I had was very much attend the lecture, listen to the things, learn the things, not quite sit down and shut up. Like, if you've got a good question, ask it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're here to work through some content, and we're here to get it done. So I'm not good at my differentiations between Socratic methods and other methods of work. Yeah. So I can't make a useful further comment, but it was very much an attend the fact and law giving session, you know, receive the facts and law to be given, and then go away and do some further study based on what you've learned in this lecture.
And I think the second question I had was around like just the mindset shift when you study law, because certainly when I came to the law from a non-law background, I was completely overwhelmed by just not just the sheer volume and material, you know, that you come across in your first, second, and third year and so on, but also the kind of approach to answering law school exams. Like, it's a very application-based assessment. You're not just regurgitating stuff and getting points for that. Although, you know, you have to know the law, you're not necessarily being examined on your ability to recite the law. It's more so about how well can you articulate your thoughts, how well can you form an opinion, a reasoned opinion, and then apply them to a fictional set of facts given, you know, the problem question. And so did you find that kind of as you were going through it, that it took a while to kind of adjust to that different way of learning? Because I did commerce as a background, so I did business and you know, economics and sort of those sorts of courses are very much, for lack of a better way, black or white, like in the sense that the way you learn is pretty clear cut, but law was quite different, I thought. So what was your experience like from that perspective?
I found the method of doing okay in exams, and I was lucky enough to do okay. I sort of describe it more as issue spotting, and that was kind of the skill that I either had or developed, or a little bit of both, that was of some use in exams. So I never felt like I was regurgitating stuff. I felt like I'd note a little issue, or even, you know, the use of a word or the use of a fiddly little detail in a fact pattern to go, aha, this is a question that really wants me to think about this. And so for me, where my mind's at in the sort of, well, was at, what are we, a couple of decades ago now, where my mind was at in the very distant past, was very much on that issue spotting type frame of mind versus a sort of regurgitation kind of point. And so if you could combine that issue spotting with a little bit of knowledge of the relevant case law and a little bit of analysis, then that was a process that was going to lead you to not fail. And if you did an okay job of it, hopefully you push past that that not fail element into some further marks as well. And so I tended to feel okay if there were issues I managed to spot. If I'm like, oh, there are like a few things have jumped out of this question, I can write for a while. Yeah. If I had that kind of feeling, I tended to feel like, yeah, I've at least spotted a couple of things that have been planted in here that they're trying to test me on.
No, definitely. That's definitely a good strategy, I think. Yeah, it just ran because a lot of like my friends as well were like, you know, and we used to have study groups and the like, all of us were like, what is going on in this question? What are they trying to ask us? You know, there's all these issues. What's the approach? And so we kind of just learned by trial and error. But I definitely agree. Like it is about issue spotting and kind of, you know, ensuring that you're prioritizing the right issues as well based on the
question. And that pattern recognition, Amoga, I think your approach in a study group is so wise because you've got a number of different brains coming in and engaging with these issues, and they'll each pick up a different way of thinking about the same topic, right? So if you're doing whatever caveatable interest or something, someone will have one way of thinking about it and you'll go, oh, the way I think about it is like this. And by sort of interrogating what's put to you and then reflecting on your own views, I think you end up with a more refined understanding.
Definitely. Now, one thing you mentioned previously was around, you know, you learned more from activities you did outside of law school. So was that sort of from your work experience? Was it from extracurricular activities you participated in? Or what kind of practical experience or knowledge did you gain sort of throughout your law school journey that held you in good stead when you kind of got into practice?
Very little for when I just got into practice, which was interesting because law school is a pretty competitive place, as a number of listeners to this podcast will be aware. And so you would often compare yourself to someone who was a receptionist at a very big firm and was looking at files and learning things and figuring out how things worked, and you know, or was a paralegal at a smaller firm, or you know would be in files and would have an understanding of how law firms work and how these things worked practically. Back to the privileges I mentioned earlier, I had some time as a paralegal, and that's very helpful. You don't understand at the time just how helpful it is to just kind of have a basic knowledge of what people in an office do, how you behave, your real kind of basic entry level things that are pretty difficult to grapple with if you haven't already had the seed planted as a younger person. So what I might call sort of basic office work competence, if I can put it that way, it is actually a fairly sophisticated set of skills that you don't appreciate at the time you're gaining them. So the ability to do any paralegal work in an office and just understand how an office works is a huge benefit. The other more co-curricular stuff was of no benefit for the first, let's say, I'll make up the term of 5 years, but for so long as I was a capital J junior lawyer, I found radio stuff, trivia hosting, making music, none of that was of any assistance at all in the early phase of my career. What's interesting is that it's in the latter phases or the middle phases, hopefully. I think I'm now in the middle phase of my career that the value of pursuing these sort of creative endeavors and the value of building relationships outside the people you're competing with or, you know, learning with and learning from at law school is very much increasingly valuable to things like marketing and business development, things like content creation, things like the ability to speak about complex topics reasonably promptly, things like issue spotting, relationship building, your kind of slightly softer skills. So those co-curricular activities and work activities were of some benefit, and that benefit sort of realized itself more fully in the middle phase of my career, which is where I consider myself to be now.
Definitely. But would you agree sort of that they were still important in the sense that, you know, they allowed you to become the sort of whole lawyer, if I put it that way, as opposed to just someone who was very well academically, but maybe didn't have as much experience sort of on the more practical, you know, aspects or soft skills, like you pointed out, that are involved in legal practice as well?
I would agree on an unqualified basis. So if you're someone who is studying at the moment, who is like, oh no, I missed out on a clerkship, or oh, someone else was brought in for that paralegal role. And so I have to keep working in the cafe or stay waking up early at the bakery or doing driving for a driving app or whatever it might be. There's an element where you can feel like you're missing out on a bit of a head start, a bit of a running start on your legal career. And that's perfectly natural. But if I can speak from the old man lawyer at the, you know, in the middle phase of his career, there are elements of that bakery job or that driving app experience or whatever it might be that will equip you with a skill set that the more time you spend in the law, you'll find increasingly valuable. Mm-hmm. So the ability to quickly relate to people isn't necessarily going to help you heaps when you've got a conveyance that's falling apart and you've only been admitted 2 weeks and you've got no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
But it might assist you when you are shaking hands and having coffee with someone who's looking to subdivide a large, you know, block of land out the back of somewhere and is just interested in kind of getting a feel for you and whether you're the sort of person they want to spend time with over a 12-month, 18-month property development project or whatever it might be. So the benefits will not be immediately evident of non-law work, but I promise they are there. And I promise the more time you spend in the profession, the more those non-legal or sort of co-curricular or sort of ancillary activities will come to show their value.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I like that. And I think even just like, you know, doing something outside of law, at least from my experience, has allowed me to kind of, you know, find a creative outlet to kind of channel some of that creativity. Because as you obviously know quite well, like law is quite a full on and can be quite full on, especially in the early years when you're still developing and kind of growing and, you know, learning the ropes really. So having something to do outside of the law, both as a student but also as a young lawyer, can be quite useful because it gives you that forum.
And it also means that the mistakes you will inevitably make, I made a mistake last week that is still irritating me. Like it doesn't matter. Mm. But if all I was a lawyer and I'd come out and I was 2 weeks out and I stuffed up a conveyance or whatever, then the most important thing in my life, I've failed at, right? Yeah. And similarly now, if all I was doing was law and I made a silly typo in a, you know, whatever it might be, then, oh God, the only thing I do in my entire life, I've just stuffed up at.
Yeah.
And so it becomes sort of an existential crisis. Whereas if you've got more perspective on the different lives other people are living and the different activities you might pursue, the different creative pursuits you might think about, not only do you get a bit of perspective on how important is that typo that you're beating yourself up about, but you also get genuinely a different area of your life to interact with different people and to understand different perspectives.
Definitely. And I think the really good lesson from that is also like just not to be overly hard on yourself, particularly for law students and like young lawyers, because I remember when I was going through it, someone told me, you know, ask yourself the question, would this mistake or event or lack of opportunity or whatever be something you look back on in 5 years' time? And if the answer is no, like immediately, then you shouldn't be, you know, wasting your time worrying about it or stressing over it or, you know, feeling bad about it, because there will be more things that come up. There'll be more learnings that come, you know, it can be applied across the board really. But the lesson there was, you know, don't dwell on things that are not going to matter, you know, sort of in the long term. Like, obviously not to say that, you know, don't learn from your mistakes, certainly not. But I think when it comes to, you know, when it comes to opportunities or the like, don't dwell on things you don't have. Like,
yeah, that perspective point is so important. I agree.
Sort of fast forwarding your law school journey now to your career in disputes. Firstly, you kind of solely practice within disputes and litigation, if I sort of put it as a broad umbrella term. How did you get into disputes and litigation, number one? And number two is, like, how did you find your niche within, you know, areas such as corporate oppression? And I have to look at my notes for this one, corporate oppression, derivative action, as well as other sort of related areas that are very niche within the sort of Corporations Act, if I put it that way. So how did you come to disputes and litigation, but then how did you find your niche?
Over time. And there's this funny line that feels true, but you sort of need to pick it apart a bit. Those of us who specialize sometimes say, oh, your specialty or your practice area comes to find you. And there's some truth to that, but I might work through my own story and we might see how much you and I agree that your practice area comes to find you. The first work I ever did was as what we might call a probate paralegal, helping out with wills and estates and doing the accounts and going off to the houses and getting cleaning all the junk out of the houses and that sort of thing. It was very nuts and bolts, hands-on, helping the executor who the law firm was acting for type stuff. And that sort of led into one of my first jobs, probably my first ever job, being just basic civil litigation. And civil litigation means non-crim, right? It could be anything aside from criminal work. And I didn't do any family law work. So no crim, no family law, just doing a bit of litigation. As that role developed, it came to be what we might loosely call estate litigation, where sort of disappointed beneficiaries of wills might seek what we sometimes call further provision from the estate of a person who has passed away. And I did that work for a little while and gained a little bit of knowledge in that area. I then moved from that area to a practice area called building and construction work. And from there, would do a lot of work on, you know, defective buildings and disputes between developers and builders and, you know, the owners corporations of buildings of reasonable size and that sort of thing. And as this sort of wills and estates into building and construction and sort of general civil litigation stuff sort of bubbled along, I found that there were funny little themes that seemed to interest me. And they were often the relationships between the sort of shareholders in companies that whose shares form part of an estate. And there were sometimes the kind of director's duties type issues that arose in respect of, a developer or some building and construction areas, or sort of just how are these businesses or how are these legal relationships set up and what happens when the people in those relationships don't get along. And those sorts of what structure are we dealing with and what happens when they don't get along questions were sort of often in the background of the primary work of like wills and estates disputes or building and construction disputes or whatever it may be. And so over time, a truism or sort of advice that is often handed down is, oh, it's more profitable for you to specialize. It's easier to market yourself. Specialty is a good thing. Mm. And so I thought, well, there's not a lot of people in commercial litigation who are saying, I specialize in these co-owners disputes, right? When co-owners don't get along, you call James. There's some appeal to that. To me, I seem to understand the area. And so I started doing a bit more research into it and kind of making sure that if people came to speak to me about co-owners disputes, that I had a useful thing to say about it. And so in parallel or sort of as part of my professional development in those roles I referred to, I would make sure that I was as well informed as I could reasonably be about sort of the various disputes that co-owners might find themselves into. Mm. And so kind of having walked down that co-owner path, you tend to understand a couple of other corollary issues that come with it. And partly through pursuing something that spoke to me a little bit, the co-owner stuff, and partly through the happy accident that some of those co-owner issues jumped up in my previous practice areas, I sort of got to the position of saying, well, I still don't see anyone holding themselves out as a specialist on this co-owner stuff. I think I've got enough skills to at least say it's an area of interest for me and I've got a little bit of knowledge. And so that sort of launched me, off the edge of the cliff to kind of say, yeah, all right, I'm going to hold myself out as this is the practice area. And regardless of what factual background or legal background the co-ownership issue might come from, I think I can hold myself out as having a reasonable first guess at what sort of solution might be proffered.
I think what I found the most interesting part of all of that was just how you were kind of keeping an eye out for these sort of underlying principles, issues, underlying, things that were going on in the background, I guess, which then ultimately kind of pushed you in a certain direction, which I feel like most of us, especially when we're juniors, like we don't tend to have that like macro outlook on things. We're focused just on the task or on the matter or on, the work that we're doing at the minute, and without kind of thinking through, okay, what's the underlying issue here at stake? Yes, the client might be having one problem, but like what's the deeper like principle going on here? Like what is the, we tend to look at it fairly linearly, I think. And so the fact that you're able to kind of look at it so broadly and not just, working on your day-to-day stuff, but then also kind of extrapolating some of these key themes or principles from all of those matters, which then ultimately pushed you in that disputes practice was quite interesting, I think. And then, yeah, I totally agree. Like specializing is quite cool. I mean, it's quite frightening for young lawyers, I think, especially because it feels like you're going to be boxed into a certain type of work or a certain type of, matters or whatever. But I think where you can find that niche for yourself and where you know that you can, do a great job of advising clients on that particular area, like it's certainly a very cool thing to do, if I put it that way.
I'll accept the compliment. Cool's never really been some sort of word associated with me, but I'll take it very, very happily, Amog. Thank you.
You know what? You're funny you mentioned that, because I've always thought of your work as cool, because you've, I mean, we'll come to your other work outside of the legal practice, but like I've always, you know, every content you've put out, any kind of case note as a foreshadow that you've put out is I've always found to be cool. So I've only associated the word cool to your work, but
okay. All right. Now let's look at the checks in the mail, Amog. I'll take that very happily.
No, that's not genuinely. But I think it's quite fascinating, if I use another adjective aside from cool. It's quite fascinating and quite intriguing. You know, if you were to give the listeners a bit of information around what does the work of a corporate litigator involve, particularly in the practice area that you work in. Because most people haven't heard the word corporate oppression or derivative actions until they've taken their corpse law class, maybe in law school. So, you know, what does the day-to-day work look like for someone like you?
Exactly the same as almost literally every other white-collar job. Mm. Send a few emails, take a few phone calls, go to a few meetings. I work substantially from home at the moment, and we're sort of working through the crunch of that. But, you know, I'm here making phone calls, taking phone calls, sending emails, reading emails, drafting documents. So the way it looks is more or less identical to a huge number of other jobs. The extra 5% is sort of attending court. Mm. And that will happen from time to time. I'm in court much less regularly than a lawyer who describes themselves as a litigator. Why don't I phrase that a different way? I think we all have an image of a litigator as someone who's in court a lot, right? Even I have that image. but look, it's now late March. I haven't been to court once this year physically. And so there's an element of like when I'm in court, it will almost literally 100% of the time be with a barrister who's been briefed. And it will be a not especially common occurrence for me. So, emails, phone calls, letters, very, very boring, superficial stuff. The background and backbone to all these emails, phone calls, letters, meetings is going to be advising co-owners in this sort of dispute kind of space. And so you might find yourself meeting with two of the one-third shareholders in a local concreting business where the founder and one-third co-owner is sort of spinning off the rails and doing all sorts of crazy things. And you might be sitting down there spending an hour or two mapping out a strategy to say, hey, look, we can go to court and spend a massive amount of money doing this, or we can think about reaching a commercially agreed outcome that avoids the need for court, or we can work through all these sorts of options. So often you find yourself almost in the position of a strategic advisor trying to partner in the thinking of your clients versus a legal analyst saying your prospects of success if you commenced pursuant to section 232 blah. Because my initial conception of law was I am a legal advice generating piece of capital, input legal issue in my eyes or ears, I will output out of my mouth or fingertips answer to legal problem. And I'm coming to understand that that's a useful background to have, but the real hard and also rewarding legal work is to sit down and partner with someone. And look, my work's always what we sometimes call one and done, right? If you're going to have a big dispute of my type, you're not having another one. So you're sort of, I like to think of myself as helping people through reasonably difficult phases in their lives or certainly their business lives.
Yeah.
And so that strategic partnership element is a significant part of what I'm having phone calls, coffees, emails about through the day.
Totally. No, that makes sense. And just kind of one thought that came to mind is, how did you ever consider being a barrister? Because you mentioned that a lot of your work that you're involved in, it involves, you know, barristers going to court, which is an uncommon thing. But did you ever envisage yourself, you know, being that person who is in the court arguing and kind of putting their case forward? Because, you know, that certainly seems to be the kind of conception that most of us have of litigators, that they're in court, that they're, you know, managing all these complicated cases, arguing for their clients, et cetera. But yeah, did that thought ever cross your mind or?
Very profoundly. And in fact, sort of this time last year, I was working through the calculus. I left a partnership or a sort of a corporate setup of a national law firm last year. And I was thinking about, yeah, okay, having done that, what are the next things look like? Do we buy a coffee cart and just, work on our muffin recipe and, start slinging cappuccinos and, banana muffins or whatever, or do we open our own law firm? Do we go to the bar? Do we become employed by a large law firm, or do we do any number of things, right? So I went through that thought process, and going to the bar appeals to me very much aesthetically, because I like being on my feet in court. It appeals to me from a rigor perspective, in that you're asked the hardest questions, you're at the sharpest point of a matter. And it also appeals to me because a lot of the people I meet at the bar I like. And you sort of think, well, okay, like you know, if the work interests me, if the people who do it seem nice, and if the kind of, I'll say, aesthetics of appearing in court with some regularity appeal to me, then why not consider it deeply? One of the short answers for that is my family. I'm a parent of a number of kids, and part of the change made last year sees me doing trying to lean in to take, 80, 85% of all the parenting stuff, while my partner in life is off running a very exciting business of their own. So the work of a barrister does not sit neatly with phoning up the judge to be like, oh, sorry, Junior has the sniffles today and I won't be coming in, or something like that. So family is very much the focus of my professional decision making, very much so at the moment, and increasingly so over time, whereas the opposite has probably been true for a decade or so, or at least it's been a fine balance. What I'm finding now is that the right thing for my family is to put my family as the first criterion in any decision-making process. And at the moment, that doesn't include having to run off and do the work of a barrister, no matter how interesting and appealing that appears to
No,
me.
that's totally fair. And yeah, I love that philosophy. I think I've adopted the same philosophy, even though I'm way, way, way junior, but I think family always comes first, irrespective of, you know, what situation you might be in, certainly from a career standpoint for me as well. The next thing I wanted to ask you was, what was your first experience like when you were just starting out as a junior solicitor? And if you can kind of reflect back on that first courtroom experience when you were briefing or instructing a barrister. What was going through your mind, your very first case, your very first court appearance? And yeah, what was that like?
I don't remember which one's the first. I've just got some sort of early days, sort of court appearances that kind of bleed into one. One of them was a weird traffic offence that I didn't fully understand when I was working at a firm in Newcastle, and a senior was like, "Oh, just say a bit of this, say a bit of that," and try to. I think I was applying for adjournment or something like that. I had no idea what I was doing. I sort of stood at the back of the court, tried to watch how some other people did it. Tried to, look over my notes of the sort of things I should be saying and that kind of thing. And it was utterly terrifying. What I was, I'm lucky in that my background includes things like radio and things like battle rap and that sort of thing, where you maintain a fairly unbroken facade whilst your brain is working overtime to try to assemble your thoughts. And so, even in my early appearance work, I didn't have any monstrous failures, despite how very nervous I was. So I look back on those early appearances with a bit of gratitude for having a skill set that allowed me not to crumble to dust. But it's the more recent appearances that I probably take more pride in part because I was better prepared for them. And, a good way to deal with nerves is to be well prepared. And then a good way to feel after an appearance, or after running a small interlocutory hearing, which is all I'd really appear at without a barrister these days. having some success at that. So those nice feelings have arrived more recently rather than the terror that used to overtake me in more early appearances.
Definitely. And yeah, I certainly can imagine if you're in front of a judge for the first time as a junior lawyer, like being in a courtroom is intimidating enough, I think, let alone when there's a judge in front of you asking you all these questions or, when you're trying to put your case forward. So yeah, I can only imagine. I'm not anywhere in litigation. I'm an employment lawyer, so I have nothing to do with litigation. And even within employment law, it's like,
Not yet, not yet.
not
I don't think so.
yet.
So
Never say
there'll
never.
be an
That's
unfair dismissal claim. Yeah, there'll be an unfair
right.
dismissal claim. You'll be running sometime soon.
Yeah, no, it's just
What a
it's
strain of
frustrating.
trade! Even more fun. Even more fun.
Definitely. Or GP claim, general protection sort of
Hey.
thing like that. So kind of going from your legal career now towards your sort of extracurricular initiatives within the law, like and there's one particular one that I'm sure you know which one it is. It's your podcast, Coffee and a Case Note. So how did you start that podcast? It's such a cool idea. It's such a cool way to both keep yourself informed about the recent developments, changes in sort of the recent cases, but also to share the wider principles with the other members of the community. So how did you start the podcast? What was your sort of driving motive?
A big matter I was running settled at about the time I was promoted to senior associate. And so I was like, oh shit, I need some work. And so my mind turned to business development. And one of the initial things I did was start posting written content on LinkedIn, written case summaries. Hey, there was a plaintiff, there was a defendant, the judge said this, isn't litigation crazy? That sort of went okay. And I spent time, a little bit of time lingering on LinkedIn and seeing that video content would pop up from time to time. And this was 6 or 7 years ago when the version of that video content would be some American salesperson in their car being like, you've got a really, delivering some really intense message about sales or something like that. And then there'd be only very, very occasional videos from lawyers. And those videos tended to fall into categories that I put in my mind in two separate categories in my mind. Category one, I'll refer to in my head as rigorous, where you'd have probably two, probably old, probably white, probably male lawyers sitting down to speak about some very technical issue. And the one that always stands out to me for whatever reason is Section 50 of the Civil Liability Act here in New South Wales. And they'll say very correct, proper, precise things that are very relevant to people practicing in the area, but they'll do so in a way that is fairly dry, and not necessarily entertaining or engaging in any way. So that's category one, right? Rigorous. Category two, is what I might call approachable. And that is a video by a lawyer that is less about the content of the law and is more almost a straight advertisement. Call Dapachi Law for all your questions about trademarks. Don't delay. Call us today on 123-4567. And they'd be delivering that in front of a banner in their boardroom or in front of a stack of old legal books, none of which they'd read or something like that. And I call that sort of category approachable. So we've got videos I was seeing that were rigorous and videos I was seeing that were approachable. And I had in my mind that I was like, I think I can do the approachable with the background in radio and that sort of thing. And I think I can do the rigorous because I've got some things to say or like some knowledge of an understanding of how these co-owners' disputes work. And so the plan, and then the venue, I was like, look, I consider myself reasonably good over a cup of coffee, right? How do I have a cup of coffee with the most people I can? Well, we do it on a video and we distribute it around the place. So what I like to think is that Coffee in a Case Note is a combination of those videos that I'll refer to as approachable, someone who's nice and smiling at you, who you'd like to spend time with, and rigorous, someone who's got reasonable knowledge of the law they're talking about and is educating you and helping you understand it as they work through the discussion. So it was a way to bring in work that hopefully was approachable and rigorous at once.
No, definitely. And I love the idea of having coffee with as many people as you can and so both delivering knowledge but also enjoying it over a cup of coffee. I love that.
That's the plan.
That's the plan. Now on the flip side of it, how do you approach that? How do you approach each coffee in a case note video? Like I'm assuming there's a lot of hours that go into preparing, both sort of reading the case, figuring out the principles, doing all of that. So most people just see the finalized product, as is the case with any podcast. But there's a lot of stuff that goes on the back end. So could you talk us a bit about your
Yes.
approach to all of that and how you manage
You know better than
time?
most, Mog. You know better than most. The prep is rereading the case and taking notes from it. And that's not light years from what I would do otherwise, which is read relevant cases in my area, reflect on what they mean, reflect on, what the facts were and whether, my client's position can be distinguished from that or not. So on one view, it's stuff I'd be doing anyway, right? That takes, for each case, I don't know, there can be very short cases that might be a cost decision that might take 45 minutes or an hour. There might be very long cases of, a few hundred paragraphs that might take 4, 5, 6 hours, never more than 10 hours. I'd be surprised if we reached 5 hours very often. So it's sort of a big, juicy 1, 2, 3 hours is kind of how I think about that, the length of time needed to read the case and make some notes on it. Some people will be faster than that. They'll be laughing at me, and some will be slower. And we all do these things at our own pace. So having done that, that's actually the hardest bit, right? Having done that, just the next position is getting my microphone. I've got a nice little wireless lavalier microphone. Getting my mobile phone. It's an iPhone that's now 4.5 years old, and it's sort of clinging on for dear life, and I'm sort of loath to replace it these days. Getting a tripod and going and sitting down in a cafe somewhere and attempting to not quite regurgitate, but similar, to work through in my head these notes that I've made. I don't work from notes as I deliver it. I very much just try to have mastery over the case. Well, mastery, have firm competence of the facts, and firm competence in understanding the law. And once the camera turns on, as it were, once the phone little red circle turns from being a big red circle to a smaller red circle, meaning that we're recording, once the red circle goes small, I then sort of stare, make eye contact with a little black circle in the phone, and then try to do my best to synthesize the facts and the law as best I remember them at the time. And then, as part of that recording process, I'll record a couple of what I call teasers. So while the camera's recording, I'll put my head down, I'll raise it back up again, and I'll go, "Hey, we just summarized a case, like the Smith and Boggs." And then I'll put my head down, raise it again, and I'll say, "Did you know that I'm the founder of this law firm? You should go and follow it." And so I use that one trip to the cafe to generate a number of different videos that I can share around the place. But yeah, look, there's this Lil Wayne line. I know Lil Wayne's very old now, and like you said, cool before. There's nothing less cool than having old white guys mention irrelevant rappers. But he has this great line where he says, "Look, I need a Grammy, an Oscar, and an Emmy. Like, I'm a one take Timmy." And I like to think of myself as a one take Timmy as well. That I just go in, I do it, and that's that. And Amog, as you know, one of the most time consuming things in content creation is sort of perfectionism slash second guessing yourself. And so one of the strengths of my approach is that I just don't, is that I'm just like, look, I will live with the standard of video I've recorded, get it out, and then I'll catch it on the next one, rather than sitting in angst and anxiously going, "Oh, I can't believe I said director when I meant to say shareholder. This is so awkward," et cetera.
No, totally. It's not having that perfectionist mindset, which is be almost better than having that mindset. I mean, I totally agree. The one take approach seems to be working quite well, at least from a, because I also think it connects more with the audience. Like, you come across as less scripted, less less like you're regurgitating the entire case or whatnot. So no, I totally agree with that. What are the key lessons that you take away from that? Because I can imagine that after going through so many cases and being able to explain those to someone, and you do it in a way that's also, if I might add, very easy to follow. It's not very legalese in the sense that if I don't know anything about corporate oppression, I'll still be able to kind of follow along and keep tabs of what's going on in the case, as opposed to just all these buzzwords, which people are just going to be like, what are you talking about? So so what has that kind of experience taught you? You mentioned a lot about the prep work and kind of how you approach this whole sort of project. But I'm sure there's some great sort of nuggets of wisdom you've picked along the way as you've
Yes.
read these cases.
Great nuggets of wisdom. It's more not so much legal insights, but about content marketing. And that is that it's so easy, so much easier to do sort of an online marketing project or a marketing project of any kind if firstly you're interested in the stuff you're talking about. You're not just doing, you know, you're just eating your vegetables or, you know, going for the run that you don't really want to have, but you know, yeah, I should really do some exercise. I should really eat my vegetables. I should really do content about topic X. So it helps to have that interest. It helps to have that approach that I referred to before, that sort of 80-20, like good enough is actually good enough in your marketing approach. And if you put out content into the universe that has a typo in paragraph 3, yeah, you feel like a bit of a goose, but it's something that you're going, you know, it's very much, it's going to wrap, you know, today's newspaper and tomorrow's fish and chips or whatever that, however that cliche goes. Yeah, there was a typo. Okay. Well, don't make a typo in the next one then, is very much the kind of approach that I'd encourage you to take. Also, this term that I've stolen from somewhere, and I don't precisely know where I've stolen it from, called pillar marketing, where your content creation strategy becomes so much easier when you don't have to come up with a pearl of wisdom to share every time you want to publish something online. So you might start a podcast and you might just know which interview subjects you'd like. And based on those interview subjects, you can keep your content strategy rolling. Or you might start an online case summary project where you just search a certain section of the Corporations Act and whatever the most recent case is dealing with that section, you're going to do a summary of that section. You don't have to sit around saying, oh, you know, I need a bolt of inspiration about what we're going to discuss this time. And so I guess, yeah, the lessons I've learned are about the 80-20 good enough is good enough. Just sort of get up, publish it. And then if you don't like it, fix it for the next one. And to try to find a kind of wellspring of not quite inspiration, but of, you know, a basis for your content that you can rely on in future.
Definitely. And I think one addition to that, which is what you spoke about earlier as well, is that find that sort of niche or gap that you can kind of fill in. Like when you mentioned you were looking at interviews that were approachable, but not necessarily rigorous, and others that were rigorous, but not approachable. And so you were able to find that kind of gap in the market, for lack of a better phrase, to kind of create this other category, which has both. And so if you can find something that, yeah, that's not necessarily different per se, but that's unique in the sense that the way you're offering it, that also kind of helps, I guess, with content. So that's pretty cool. One thing I wanted to ask you now is you started your own firm, Gravamen. I think I pronounced that right. How did you come up with the name, first of all? And could you tell the listeners a bit about the firm and your decision to start your own business as the next step in your career?
Yes, the name is derived from, I think, Latin, and it has a meaning similar to gravity. And it sort of means the central part of an argument or the central part of a dispute of like, yeah, we're arguing about all this stuff and you know, there are all these difficulties, but what's the gravamen? What's the fundamental central point? And so by choosing the name, I sort of wanted to communicate that the firm, like there are lots of good firms out there, lots of great firms out there. This firm, I'm hoping, you know, will join there, come to be thought of in that way in time. And it is a firm that is concerned with the central point. It's concerned with the gravamen. It's not concerned with other stuff. It's a term also used by judges from time to time, though not especially often. And so there's a nice sort of if you know, you know kind of energy to it as well. I get messages from lawyers from time to time that are like, oh, wow, I was in court and someone used the term gravamen and the only reason I knew what it meant was because of you. And that's nice to hear, right? And so I want it to be a firm that is about that, right? That is about understanding how litigation works, that is about getting to the heart of an issue and not really worrying about extraneous stuff.
Yeah.
Almost 80-20, but look, let's not put that on our marketing stuff. how did I come here? It's almost a similar response to the one about going to the bar, about becoming a barrister that I referred to earlier, in that a big part of Graberman's job is it needs to work around my life and my family's life. And at the moment, that's a heavy at-home commitment, heavy domestic commitment. And Graberman's going to find itself, you know, wound up pretty quickly if it can't work in a way that works for me and my family.
Yep.
Now, because Graberman is not extremely unsuccessful at the moment, there's a fair bit of coffees at 11 p.m. there's a fair bit of weekend sort of, you know, finding little moments where I can steal a couple of hours here, there, and everywhere. And there's an element where the future form of Graberman might not be quite so able to sort of fit within the cracks of life. But for the moment, its purpose is to serve its clients and also to serve its owner.
Yeah.
and its owner's family.
Yeah.
And so for so long as its owner's family is being served, and for so long as the clients are continuing to come, which, you know, knock on wood, has not been a problem thus far. Long may that last, fingers crossed. For so long as it's doing those things, that's very much the plan. I saw you cross your fingers there. I'm grateful. I'll take that energy. And Graberman thanks you. You've got the you've got the Graberman gratitude.
Perfect. No, that's fantastic. And I think we can talk about that for sort of days, for hours and hours and hours, particularly on starting your own business. But I think what I want to close with is just asking you for your advice to a bunch of different categories of individuals. So let's start with aspiring lawyers, law students, as well as aspiring litigators, or those interested in kind of practicing within the disputes and litigation field broadly. So what would you sort of say to each of those individuals?
To law students, I'd say it's worth it. And that's really kind of the thrust of the advice. Noting that I need to check the privileges that we mentioned earlier in the episode, what you will find when you emerge with your degree is a profession that has really high barriers to entry and will throw up really serious challenges to you as you're trying to make the initial moves in your career, and it'll be confusing and difficult and stressful and strange and sometimes infuriating and often confusing. But if I can speak from 20 years down the track, it's worth it. And I say it's worth it, not to say never think twice about it, never consider an alternative career. No, certainly keep your mind open to whatever life has to throw at you. But if you do resolve or find that it is a profession for yourself, then there is space for people who have reasonable mental health, who are reasonably aligned with their values, who are enjoying their time and enjoying a financial reward as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the decades down the track. So it's worth it. I know you're walking through the pain at the moment. Then to aspiring litigators, that's slightly more difficult to give firm advice on, but just you want to be spending time around people doing the work that you want to be doing. And sometimes you'll find yourself in a firm, say, that does a number of different practice areas, and you might be working in the conveyancing section where you're buying and selling houses, and your dream might be to be an insurance litigator one day. It's worth making friends with the partners in that practice. It's worth getting coffees with the associates who do that work. It's worth reading a couple of the recent cases. And if I may be blunt, it's also worth staying in contact with the recruiters. It's worth keeping your ears to the ground of how do happy and successful people in this practice area that I aspire to be in go about their work? How do I move closer to them? And it might be there's an opportunity in your firm to move closer to them, or it might be that you need to look elsewhere. But yeah, keeping your ear to the ground and understanding what really goes on in that practice you aspire to be a part of.
No, definitely.
Well, you should also subscribe to YouTube channels that yes. do good summaries of litigation and tell all your friends. That's the other thing. In fact, that's the advice for everyone. For anyone, go find those YouTube channels and tell all your friends about them.
Definitely. And maybe start with Coffee in a Case Note if you're interested. And you can kind of see see other channels as well. But no, that makes perfect sense. I think the it's worth it part is so rarely echoed by senior lawyers, because you know, you kind of get to that stage where you're like, is it even, I'm putting all these hours in, I'm putting all this effort in. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't necessarily, even when you said earlier around like those paralegal or sort of non-law experiences as well, when you do them at the time, you don't necessarily think that they're going to have any benefits, but in the long term they probably do have some benefits, you know, with skills or whatever else. And so yeah, it's really good to hear and refreshing to hear that it is worth it in the long run, irrespective of the practice area you might be in. But
you'll find people who give the opposite advice, Amog, as well. I'm sorry to say, but look, that's my view.
No, totally. And look, I think I'm an eternal optimist. Like, even if there is, even if it isn't worth it, for example, for argument's sake, I would still like to hear that it is worth it. So, no, I appreciate you.
Ignorance is bliss. Yeah.
Exactly. I would like to live in that denial for the moment. So, and I appreciate you being so positive and so optimistic. But no, thank you so much for that advice. I think, and thank you on a personal note as well for coming on the show. I feel like it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show, and also just to hear about your experience and all the kind of useful nuggets of wisdom, if I use that expression again, for all the law students. So, and everyone generally. So thank you so much for taking the time and having a chat.
Thank you for having me, Amog. A real privilege and pleasure, and great fun to chat. May it not be the last.
No, definitely not. Yeah, I'll put the fingers crossed to sign up again.
Hey, thank you.